Beautiful Simon and Garfunkel song there, America from Bookends. And the reason I played that is in honor of our special guest, who is kind of an expert on Simon and Garfunkel, not to mention a whole bunch of other kinds of music from the 1960s and beyond. He has been in radio, as I mentioned, about as long as I have been alive. Because I was born in 64, and I think that's around the years that he was getting started at the radio station where he still is now, although there were some other places in between. So without much further ado, I want to welcome the author of Simon and Garfunkel's Bookends, also the author of Back to the Garden, a book about Woodstock that we'll be discussing, and of course, the host of Mixed Bag on WFUV-FM 90.7 in New York every Saturday from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 8. Would you please welcome to the neighborhood Pete Fornatel. Hello, Pete.
Fanfare. How you doing, Dave? Good morning.
Oh, I'm great, Pete. And how are you? You mentioned off the air that you have a little bit of a cold.
Yes, change of season. It always happens, change of season. And here we are, let's see, December 22nd, I guess, is when winter officially begins. So I'm right on schedule, apparently.
Well, let me ask you one thing. As a radio person, you sound fine. Your voice sounds great and not having nose or throat trouble to our ears. What do you do when you're well enough to do the show, but you're really under the weather? What are your, as a radio broadcaster, how do you medicate?
I am an inveterate tea and honey guy. I find it very soothing, and I also find it medicinal. There's also adrenaline. You know, I've gone to work with an illness of some sort or other, and while the show is on, you're so focused on what you're doing that you don't feel any of the symptoms. As soon as the show is over, though, and everything sort of comes crashing down, all of a sudden the sore throat is back, the ears are popping, all of that stuff. It's sort of a miraculous devotion to duty that gets us through this sometimes when illness is a part of the picture.
It's true. I remember interviewing a few years back a singer named Maud Maggart. She's kind of in the cabaret vein. She's actually Fiona Apple's sister. And I asked her about that, and she said that there's this thing called doctor theater, where if you have to go on stage, whatever is in your head or whatever illness is swirling around you, it's just this something that kicks in about 30 seconds before you go past the opening of the curtain. And you get through it, and you do it.
I'm a firm believer in the mind-body connection and how the two are, you know, interwoven throughout our lives. And those of us who, you know, are in public media, we have this added responsibility, I guess you would call it, where you have to be at your best when you're doing your job communicating with people. And it's just amazing what the mind over matter, I guess, is the cliche that came out of this years and years ago. But I believe firmly that it exists.
Yeah. We are talking with Pete Fornatel of WFUV, Mind Over Matter. And are you of the Woodstock mindset? First of all, are you a child of Woodstock? I don't think you were physically there, but certainly spiritually you were there. And I guess that has informed your sensibility in an extremely strong way. Am I kind of right about that?
No, that is correct. You know, the irony about Woodstock for me is that when I got my job at WNEW-FM in July of 1969, the very first live commercial that I ever read on the radio, having come from non-commercial radio, no less, but the first live commercial that I ever read on the air was for the Woodstock Music and Art Fair.
Oh, wow.
And I remember thinking to myself, hey, this sounds pretty good. I'm definitely going to go to this show. But the program director had different ideas. You know, his point of view was, hey, we're going to need someone back here at the radio station to do fill-ins and news reports. You're elected. I was the new kid on the block, not much bargaining power.
Sure.
With the program director. You know what that's like, Dave, I'm sure. And so I literally spent that weekend running news reports back and forth between the WNEW AM newsroom and the WNEW FM studio. And it was while that weekend unfolded that I made this promise to myself that any time I sat in front of a microphone with someone who had been there either on stage, backstage, or in the audience, I would get their story. So over 40 years, I collected an enormous number of reminiscences about the festival. Now, in my mind, they were for radio specials, which I did do on all of the major anniversaries, including the 1st and the 5th and the 10th and the 25th. And in some respects, they keep getting bigger. The 40th was one of the biggest of them all, and I assume that in a mere 8 years, the 50th will be another international story. But my oldest son, who did not go into the family business of radio, he turned toward print and is a writer and an editor and a book packager. He came to me a couple of years ago after the Simon and Garfunkel book and said, "Do you want to do another one?" And I said, "What do you got?" And he said, "2009 is the 40th anniversary of Woodstock." And I said, "Woodstock, I've got half the book done already." I had to go into the closet and dig out these reel-to-reel tapes, have them digitized, transcribed, then edited all of the first-person accounts that I had collected for 40 years, and that is about half the content of Back to the Garden, the story of Woodstock.
And that, by the way, is from Touchstone Books. And the other half was your writing about your feelings on it or the history of it. What's the other half of the book?
Well, it was, all of this was my son's idea. Every suggestion he made it a better book. Now, here's a kid who was born 3 years after Woodstock happened, but he gets it. And it was his idea to do an oral history, which is a very popular format these days for, historical and musical historical events, and a point of view from my catbird seat at the most influential FM radio station in the country at the time, WNEW-FM. And it really worked like a charm. It was also his idea to tell the story from the beginning of the festival Friday afternoon with Richie Havens to the end, Jimi Hendrix on Monday morning, and then add the backstory at an appropriate point throughout. For example, we don't tell the Max Yazger story until that moment when he appeared on stage Sunday afternoon and addressed the crowd with that famous speech, "I'm a farmer." You know the one, I'm
right.
Sure.
Now, let me ask a couple of more questions about Woodstock, though. In retrospect, are you sorry that you missed it? Or, are you kind of happy you missed the mud and the, God knows where you would have been in that giant sea of humanity? Because everybody wants to, we see the Scorsese movie, we read the books, we'll hear your radio specials. And, oh, wow, wouldn't it have been amazing to see Sly and the Family Stone or Richie Havens or whoever, The Who, Grateful Dead, whatever. And then you start to think about, wait, I would have had to get out of my car, walk 7 miles, get rained on, not get to a bathroom, not seeing anything, barely heard anything, being afraid of lightning. I mean, it sounds actually pretty horrible.
I've been doing interviews about the book for 2 years now, and no one has asked a better question than you just did. I'm serious. No one has specifically said, would you prefer to have been there or not been there? And so, therefore, I can reveal to you that I'm thrilled with the way things turned out.
Well,
it was very nice to be in the air-conditioned studios of WNEW-FM in August of 1969, as opposed to the mud at Yazger's farm.
Well, now let me ask, since you've gotten all these different oral histories, and have you talked to Michael Lang as part of the whole thing? Is he in there?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So here's my question, because this is just one of these weird serendipitous things, but only a couple of months ago, we talked to Elliot Tiber on the radio program, the author of Taking Woodstock.
The movie. I thought the movie would have a greater impact But it really didn't. It disappeared very quickly. You know, I think Eliot's story is a sidebar at best, really.
Right.
He's an interesting, colorful character. But, you know, I think people have a tendency to inflate their own importance in some sort of bid for immortality. You know, and while I think Tiber's story is a sidebar, it's an asterisk. I don't really think that it is a primary story, and maybe that's why the movie didn't do as well as people had anticipated. Although I'll tell you two things about the film, or maybe three. I was asked to head up a panel discussion about it in Washington, D.C. by the magazine called The Nation.
Oh, yeah.
And I love to see a movie without any predispositions about it, you know, just have it unfold without reading anyone's review or discourse about it. And so there I was watching this film in Washington, D.C. for the first time before heading up this panel discussion.
Yeah.
And the three things that have stayed with me now are the lead, the fellow who played Eliot in the movie.
He was really good.
Very, very talented stand-up comedian named Dimitri Martin,
yeah.
I believe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I loved his stand-up that I had seen on Conan O'Brien or any of the late-night shows. Plus, he had his own half-hour show on Comedy Central for a while. And it's always interesting to see someone take the steps away from stand-up comedy into another medium, whether it be film or the stage or whatever. I mean, that was a path that certainly Woody Allen traversed many, many, many years ago.
Okay. Well,
and I was interested to see how Martin would carry himself. I thought he was a great leading man, very charming, but it certainly didn't launch a film career for him. The second thing about the movie was Liev Schreiber. He played a transvestite in the film, and I thought it was so good, I thought he should have been nominated both as Best Supporting Actor and Best Supporting Actress that year. But that didn't happen.
It's a wonderful performance.
And the third thing was, there was someone in the film playing a reverend, and I knew he was familiar to me. And, I thought he gave a terrific performance, and I said, who is this guy? Who is this guy? Turned out to be Richard Thomas, John Roy from the Waltons.
Yeah.
And he was great. He was great in the role. But, you know, when someone makes an impression on you through national television with a hit series, that's kind of the image that you keep of them almost for the rest of their lives and career, you know? And when somebody makes a radical turn into some other kind of characterization, it's sometimes difficult to accept the person. Because you're seeing, oh, that's Carol O'Connor, that's Archie Bunker.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute, that's the Fonz, that's Henry Winkler. And it's almost the same with Richard Thomas, but I think he has had a very successful adult career for himself and isn't only John Boy in our imaginations anymore.
Well, it helps that he does a ton of theater. He's almost in a Broadway or off-Broadway show every other season. So I've been seeing him in that.
A ton of voiceover work for car commercials, yes.
Well, but there you want him to be John Boy. There you want this simple, honest person telling you, buy this car. That's okay. He can be John Boy. When he's in an Edward Albee play, it's rather different.
This is true.
So let me ask, I wasn't really trying to aggrandize, by the way, the Eliot Tiber story and the Taking Woodstock stuff. I think he admits as much as anybody that he's kind of an asterisk that he brought Michael Lang and Yasgur together. It's just some people say he didn't even do that. He just sort of happened to be there. So, you know, but it's not as if he's saying, I was responsible for Woodstock. I mean, he's pretty clear on that when I interviewed, that he's telling his story and that it's not, I created this. Yeah. So I thought I would want to get that out there. But the other question that I have for you is, when they had, I guess it was the 20th, maybe it was the 30th anniversary of Woodstock, and they tried to do another one. And it just, it ended up being a disaster in some ways, and you know, turned into a riot, and there were fires. What happened? Why couldn't Woodstock happen again properly?
Corruption. Corruption of the ideal. Any attempt at linking Woodstock 2 or Woodstock 3 to the original is such a farce to me, because they were, from the get-go, part of this greed mentality, as best exhibited by the Michael Douglas role in Wall Street, that it is just a farce to me to even attempt to compare those two to the original. The original stands alone. There had never been anything like it before. There hasn't been anything like it since. And in a post 9/11 world, there will never be anything like it again. End of story. So, you know, what, even if you had the rights or the logo, or you tried to cash in on the cachet of the original Woodstock, that is just nonsense. The event now stands alone as a the high water mark of the 60s counterculture or progressive rock, whatever label or umbrella that you want to put over it. And it is just a standalone event that I think people will try and figure out long after the last person who actually physically attended the festival is dust and no longer on the planet. And part of my son and my hopes for the book is that, you know, for future generations trying to figure out what that weekend in upstate New York was all about, you know, will come to the book as a source of some real information about what it means, what it meant, how it happened, and how it will be remembered going forward.
The book being Back to the Garden by Pete Forignatel on Touchstone Books. That is your second. Well, actually, I think you've written a couple of books and parts of other books. But your other major, fairly recent book has to do with Simon and Garfunkel, where you
That is correct. It's so appropriate that you started out with America, because that song represented such a leap in Paul's songwriting back in 1968. I hope you don't mind, Dave, but I'd like to get out there that I'm sort of a technical Neanderthal. I write my books with Bic pens and yellow legal pads, but a good friend of mine has created a PeteForignatel.com where your listeners can dial it up and check out anything about me or the books that they might be interested in as a result of this interview today. PeteForignatel.com. Couldn't be any simpler than that. But Simon and Garfunkel, yes. America's from the Bookends album, and I wanted to write about Bookends rather than Bridge Over Troubled Water, because to me, Bridge Over Troubled Water represented the duo shredding apart. That album had more hits and was more successful and won more awards, but you can almost hear Paul considering a solo career on that album. And you almost hear Artie phoning in his part from the movie set that he was working on at the time, Catch 22. Quite the opposite with Bookends. Bookends was that point in Simon and Garfunkel's career where they really took control of their own destiny. You know, not only did they write the songs and arrange them and perform them, but they went into the control room and, you know, produced and mixed them as well. So in terms of a highlight for the duo's career, I would always go to the Bookends album rather than either Bridge Over Troubled Water or Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. And the other thing about that book is there are a lot of books these days that are about a single album. Mm-hmm. But most of them are told from the perspective of today, the older artist looking back. What's different about the Bookends album is that by a quirk of fate, I interviewed Simon and Garfunkel twice at Fordham University in the 60s. I believe it was December of 66 and then October of 67, when they were in the act of creating the album Bookends.
Wow.
And I managed to save those interviews all of those years. And so when the Bookends book was done, we had the artists in the act of creation telling the story, as well as the artists 40 years later looking back at what they had done over that span of time. So that, to me, is the intriguing part about the Bookends album. It was also Simon and Garfunkel's entry into the concept album sweepstakes. You know, that was a very popular notion in the 60s. I think the classic ones are Brian Wilson's Pet Sounds in 1966,
mm-hmm.
The Beatles' Sgt. Pepper in 1967,
right.
The Who with Tommy in 1969, and if I were to pick one from 1968, it would be Side One of Bookends. That was Paul Simon's suite of songs about the life cycle. You know, it begins with the Bookends theme, goes into Save the Life of My Child. You have America, the Kids on the Bus. You have Overs, the sort of end of a relationship. You have the voices of old people. And then the song that has almost come to define Simon and Garfunkel, Old Friends. Old Friends, back to the Bookends theme to wrap it up. Now, in 1968, Paul Simon was a 20-something songwriter who wrote this lyric that goes, "Can you imagine us years from today sharing a park bench quietly? How terribly strange
to be 70. Of course, yeah.
Well, Paul turned 70 on October 13th, and Artie followed him on November 5th. You know, back in 68, turning 70 was like science fiction. It was Buck Rogers. It was so futuristic that it wasn't even worth thinking about. And yet now to see that for those two guys, that milestone has passed. I think it's, there are two noteworthy birthday references in rock and roll. One was by Paul McCartney on the Sgt. Pepper album. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Well, that happened 5 years ago for Paul.
Right, yeah.
And the other one was How Terribly Strange to be 70 for Simon and Garfunkel, and that just happened in the last 2 months. It's a real good reminder of how quick this trip on this planet is for all of us in the end.
Let's hear a little bit of Simon and Garfunkel, the Bookends theme. Simon and Garfunkel there from Bookends, the album that we are discussing with Pete Forignatel, who is the author, the author of Simon and Garfunkel's Bookends. I guess that's part of a Rock of Ages series. Is that how it works? Is that?
Yeah, but that was my son's series for Rodale Press. He got six authors doing a single book about an individual album. Dave Marsh did one about the Beatles. There was one about Led Zeppelin IV. There was one about Layla and other love songs. And as I said earlier, when he came to me and said, would you like to do one about Simon and Garfunkel, he had Bridge Over Troubled Water in mind. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do it, but only if it's Bookends, not Bridge. And fortunately for both of us, he went along with it.
Well, yeah, I think you had an in with the editor. That's always kind of helpful.
It's nepotism in reverse, I think.
There you go. I'm so glad Rodale's is still around. I mean, I remember when they used to publish, like, magazines in Yiddish and do all sorts of weird stuff, and now they're I'm just so glad they're in that pop culture thing, that they're still out there, because that's an old firm. unless I'm mistaken.
Well, they built their reputation on health books. They do Prevention Magazine, which is a very popular publication. And they were so successful that they wanted to expand into pop culture, and that's where my son is an expert. His three areas. I'm losing my voice as we speak.
And you have to go on the radio for 4 hours later today. I'm sorry about that. But
yes. Don't you love this new technology, Dave? Now, people listening to you can probably find Mixed Bag on the web today at WFUV.org, 4 to 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
Unless you have a basketball game at Fordham, but yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there you go. But I'll be doing something that I think you're doing as well. Hubert Sumlin was a guest on my show about 4 years ago when he had a new recording out with that Keith Richards had helped him with, and Eric Clapton and David Johansen had helped him with. And I found him to be just such a delightful soul. A talented man who was a connection to the kind of rhythm and blues that really can claim parenthood of rock and roll. And, you know, we've lost so many of these guys already, and now to have lost Hubert, I think, is a terrible loss. But I was thrilled to have had this opportunity to hear his story from his mouth, and that's what I'll be rerunning this afternoon for an hour of my show.
Oh, I'm totally gonna listen, because I'm also a huge Howlin' Wolf fan. I would love, just fascinated to hear anything about Wolf, because all the things you sort of think about him aren't necessarily true. You know, he's a rather educated fellow, and just one of my very, very favorites. So I'll be playing some.
Let me whet your appetite with a story that you can look forward to. Ooh. That Hubert told me.
Yeah.
You know, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf were really rivals. You know, they were, you know, basically mining the same audience to a certain degree. And Hubert witnessed a moment late in their lives when they were both suffering from various illnesses or whatever, but they reached across the rivalry to that connection that they had with the blues and with music. And, you know, he described it as just one of those tremendous moments where you see these giants who are supposed to be enemies just coming together as human beings at the end of their lives and careers. I was just delighted with that story, and it'll be back on the radio this afternoon.
So thrilled to hear that. And that kind of leads to another question I had for Pete Fornatel of Mixed Bag on WFUV in New York. Having been on the radio since the mid-1960s, over, you know, where you are now at Fordham University, and then through the NEW years and the K-Rock years, you must have amassed this extraordinary collection of interviews with incredibly famous and important rock personages. How much of that is still is salvaged, be it on reel-to-reel or whatever? and what can be done with those archives so that at some point they can be made available in some way?
Boy, do you ask good questions.
That's
another one that no one up till now has bothered with. Yes, you're absolutely right. I have about 700 hours of reel-to-reel tapes, only a fraction of which has been published in either the Simon and Garfunkel or the Woodstock books. So, yes, I am thinking about a memoir that would include my encounters with Ringo Starr and George Harrison and Mick Jagger and Jerry Garcia and on and on and on and on and on. But the immediate product, the next book, Dave, I don't know if this will be a scoop for your listeners or not, but the next book that I am up to my ears in right now is called 50 Licks, and it's about the Rolling Stones' 50th anniversary that happens next year. They played their first gig as the Rolling Stones on July 12th, 1962. So this coming July, it will be 50 years that an entity known as the Rolling Stones has been on the planet. And we are furiously trying to get a book together that will celebrate that anniversary. And, of course, since the group still exists, you know, unlike the Beatles or so many others, since the group still exists, there's the possibility of three of the original members being back out there on the road to celebrate that milestone in 2012. And if my book gets a ride on those coattails, I would be thrilled, thrilled to death.
Is that also going to be a Rodale? Do you have a contract or whatever?
No. This one, let's see. Rodale was Simon and Garfunkel.
Right.
Simon and Schuster. Touchstone was Woodstock. And this one will be Bloomsbury Press. I had not heard of Bloomsbury, I'm ashamed to admit. And when they made an offer for the book, I looked them up, and it turns out that in England, Bloomsbury is the company that produces the Harry Potter books. So
yow.
We're in good company once again.
Yeah, well, who wouldn't turn down a Rolling Stones book with actual, you know, interview encounters way back when? Well, did you meet Jagger and the other people, or did you just talk to Jagger?
Yeah, I've got my famous encounter with Jagger happened in 1989 when I switched from WNEW-FM to K-Rock. I was there about a month, and my program director at the time, still very viable force in New York radio, Mark Chernoff, he's at WFAN right now, the sports station, but he wanted to make a big splash of my having left NEWFM after 20 years and joining K-Rock, that he set up an interview with Jagger at Shea Stadium, when the Stones were doing a series of concerts there in October of 1989 on the Steel Wheels tour. And NEW at the time didn't get an interview with the Stones, but K-Rock did. And it was such a coup and such a great way to sort of, begin my 7 years at a new radio station. And Jagger was delightful. I mean, I was nervous. And he made me feel at ease. You know, he said, I live in New York. I've heard your broadcasts. I enjoy them very much. You know, he's the ultimate politician. You never quite know whether it's sincere or not, but it doesn't matter. It's Mick Jagger, for God's sake. So it was a wonderful encounter in Davy Johnson's office. Davy Johnson was the manager of the Mets at the time.
Of course, yeah.
And the Stones had converted it into an oasis in the desert. There were flowing draperies and women dressed up as harem girls, and you know, all of the food and aromas that one might imagine in such a situation. And all of a sudden, this jock dressing room was turned into this fabulous oasis at Shea Stadium. It was a great, great night, a great, great interview, and that will certainly be a centerpiece of this
that's
new book that I told you about.
And I've heard that about Jagger, too. I know, or I interviewed at one point, I don't remember if it was on this radio show or somewhere else, but I think it was on Dave's Gone By, the fellow who ran the official Rolling Stones fanzine for a bunch of years. I mean, literally when he was in high school, and they brought him up from high school, and he was their official fanzine guy for several years. And one time he was interviewing Jagger in like that Park Avenue penthouse apartment that he had, and Jagger couldn't have been nicer and whatever, and the kid accidentally knocked over like a glass of orange juice onto this perfect white fluffy carpet. And Jagger just ran and got towels and started blotting the carpet. And the kid is sitting there mortified. And Jagger couldn't have been, I mean, because it wasn't even like his room. It was Bianca's space. She had designed the whole thing. And he was just, oh, my God. And Jagger couldn't have been better. He wasn't happy about it, but it couldn't have been kinder and nicer. So it's kind of a cute story.
This sounds like someone I should track down for an interview. Do you happen to remember the name?
Off the top of my head, no, but if I interviewed him on this show, I'll just scroll down the archives of Dave's Gone By, and I'll be able to find him pretty easily.
Those are the kinds of stories we're looking for. Little things that maybe before have never been a part of the bigger Stone story. Let me tell you a real quick one.
Sure.
My son's friend grew up in Weston, Connecticut, which is where Keith Richards and Patty raised their kids over the years. And he went to school with Keith's daughters. And they were at Keith's home one day for a date or a play date or whatever you'd want to call it, as teenagers. And Richards walks into the room with a Bowie knife in his hand.
Okay.
You know, those big, huge knives. If you're a Davy Crockett fan, you'll remember that that Bowie was one of the characters at the Alamo, and he had this, what has come to be called a Bowie knife. And it has this very sharp point, and he was, you know, picking his teeth with it and just casually making small talk with these boys. And as he was leaving the room, he looks over his shoulder with the knife in his hand, and he says, "Respect my daughters."
Wow!
Now, this is the group that had headlines in the '60s. Would you let your daughter date a Rolling Stone? Boy, it's life certainly turns on a dime as things move along on the journey, don't they?
Oh, that is wonderful. I mean, I haven't had the time, but I started reading the Keith Richards bio life. And it's really exciting to read his kind of prose. It's a long, long book, but I want to get into it. Obviously, I assume you're reading that for research, if you haven't already.
It's the most successful rock biography ever. And you know, who'd have thought, lo these many years later, A, that Keith Richards would still be alive,
right,
let alone a best-selling author. And yet, there it is. There you have it. Great storyteller, great artist. I have to be passionate about the stories I tell. And I am passionate about Simon and Garfunkel, and I am passionate about Woodstock, and I certainly am passionate about the Rolling Stones.
Did you ever get to interview Bob Dylan?
No, I met Bob a number of times, but never got him to sit down in the chair and face the inevitable one-on-one. It's my best story, and maybe we can wrap up with this, Dave.
Sure, sure.
In 1970, I was doing the morning show at WNEW-FM, 6 to 10. Ruins your life. I don't know if you've ever done that shift, but...
I've done was, 3 to know, 6 at Stony Brook, so that's worse.
Oh. Yeah, well, it was burning the candle at both ends for me, but I got invited to a championship heavyweight prize fight at Madison Square Garden. Muhammad Ali was on his way back from the draft problem that kept him out of boxing for about two and a half years, and he was doing some tune-ups before those famous heavyweight fights of the 70s. And one of them was at Madison Square Garden with an Argentinian boxer by the name of Oscar Bonavina. Mm-hmm. And a famous record company person, deceased now, Neil Bogart, invited me to be his guest at this bout. Yeah. And I'm not a big boxing fan. I think it's a brutal sport. But, I Ali transcended that. And I was, my father, as a young man, was a boxer, so I was always curious about it. And so I accepted the invitation. And I'm sitting ringside with Neil Bogart, and the other guy in our party was the great Curtis Mayfield.
Wow.
Curtis Mayfield of The Impressions, and he was just launching his own label and a solo career at the time. And in between one of the preliminary bouts and the main event, I look over to my left, and who's sitting there but Bob Dylan? Bob Dylan, the guy who wrote "Who Killed Davy Moore," is sitting ringside at this event. And I'm saying, you know, what the hell is he doing here? What the hell am I doing here? But what the hell is he doing here? And I point him out to Neil Bogart, and Bogart says to me, "Oh, you got to bring Curtis over to meet Bob Dylan." And you know, I felt conflicted because, on the one hand, I don't like to invade anybody's space, particularly when they look like they don't want to be bothered. And by the other hand, here's the guy who invited me to this fight, asked me to do a favor. How can I turn him down?
Yeah.
Well, here's how I rationalized it. I remembered that on the cover of Bringing It All Back Home, the Bob Dylan album where he's with the mysterious woman in red and he's got a pussycat on his lap, and there's a coffee table with a Time magazine with Lyndon Johnson on the cover. There's a couple of record albums on the coffee table. One of them is Robert Johnson. One of them is Lottie Lenya. And one of them is The Impressions. And I knew that couldn't have been just an accident or a coincidence, so I just surmised that he was a fan. So I took Curtis by the hand, walked over to Dylan. As I got closer, I saw him shrinking down in his seat a little further. And I said, "Excuse me, Bob, I'm Pete Fornatale from WNAW-FM." He brightened. He knew me. He knew me. You know, if you lived in New York then, that was the station that you listened to. And I hadn't really absorbed that yet. So at first he was being welcoming. And then when I said, "I got someone here who really wants to meet you, Curtis, maybe," he jumped out of his seat and embraced the guy.
Cool.
And they were, you know, exchanging a mutual admiration society. And I'm there with my arms crossed saying, "Hey, I made this happen." You know, that's one of my little asterisks, like Tiber. That's one of my little asterisks in rock and roll history. I'm the guy who introduced Curtis Mayfield to Bob Dylan at a Muhammad Ali fight. And could you do any more name dropping in any single story? I don't think so.
Well, let me tell you, way, way back in the early days of the show, I interviewed Al Aronowitz, and he takes credit for introducing the Beatles to marijuana by setting them up with Dylan. I don't know if that story is true.
Yeah, that's a great story. Do you know the genesis of that? Dylan misheard the lyric in I Want to Hold Your Hand. I'll get by. And he heard it as, "I get high, I get high." He thought they were already turned on to weed. And, I mean, that's almost too fictional to be true, and yet it is true. Bob Dylan turned on the Beatles. How incredible is that?
Well,
on that note,
you
I'm
going to
get some of that tea and honey.
Yeah,
because I got a Hubert Sumlin show to do later. But I got to tell you what a delight this was, and you know, for you know what it's. I'm sure you know that when you're interviewed over and over and over again about the same subjects, that the questions tend to be the same, and
sure,
you just have to deal with that as part of the process. But you came up with a couple of real new ones and good ones today that made me very happy about this encounter. So I thank you for that. Have a great show, a great holiday season, and let's do it again.
You got it. That's Pete Fornatale. Everybody go to PeteFornatale.com to find out about his two books. And everybody listen today and every Saturday, 4 to 8 p.m. New York time on WFUV 90.7 in New York, WFUV.org, to Mixed Bag. Pete Fornatale, feel better. Thank you so much, and come back to the neighborhood anytime. Bye-bye now.
Thanks, Dave.